originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and joining you from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio, I would like to thank everyone listening to us here on the Horse Racing Radio Network on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you listening to the website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to former riders who have given everything to the sport and have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit their website. That's www.pdjf.org. So our guest tonight, one of the most familiar faces in racing, she had a very successful riding career that spanned over 10 years, multiple graded stakes victories, and she retired in 1998 as the second leading female jockey in the country by money earned. Now we see her working for NBC during the Breeders' Cup and Triple Crown coverage, among many other events, as the on-track reporter interviewing the winning jockeys from horseback. With 1,171 victories and over $18 million in earnings, it is a pleasure to introduce jockey Donna Barton Brothers. Donna, welcome to the show.
Hi, Christina. Thanks for having me on the show. Good to talk with you.
So excited to have you here, Donna. And you come from a family of racing. I guess it was kind of in your destiny to become involved in the industry. And your mother is so fascinating. She was one of the first half a dozen women to be licensed as a jockey in the United States. And tell us a little bit, let's start off and describe what it was like growing up with her and her accomplishments.
Well, my mother was fascinating in many ways. So even before she became one of the first female jockeys to be licensed in the United States, before she was 19 years old, she had been an exhibition bull rider, a trick rider on the rodeo circuit, a card dealer in Las Vegas, like at the card table, not car salesman, card dealer in Las Vegas, and a semi-truck driver, and she weighed about 110 pounds. So she had always been willing to step out of the conventional box. You know, born in 1944, a lot of the things she was doing back then were definitely against the grain, but she just wasn't willing to live in anybody else's box or idea of what was going to be, you know, the best version of herself. So she wasn't afraid to explore. And I just love that about her. You know, I grew up in this household with this woman who was just this amazingly strong pioneer of a woman. And that was my normal. Like I didn't know that not all women were this way. I was never repressed or oppressed in any way. I will say, to my mother's credit, if she ever felt any sort of discrimination or any sort of gender bias, she certainly never gave it words like that. And so she might feel like, you know, so-and-so is not riding me because I'm not good enough or they don't know how good I am, but she would either get better or prove to them how good she was. And yeah, it was just really pretty amazing. Now, for me, the thought of becoming a jockey seemed like a pretty mundane idea, though.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I was around it all the time. All of her friends were jockeys. My brother and sister both wanted to be jockeys. And I was not that fascinated with it. I thought it would be a lot cooler to be something like a politician or an attorney. Or
wow.
But thank God I came to my senses and I started getting on horses. I don't have a memory of the first time I ever rode. We were just always around horses. But I started getting on thoroughbred horses professionally at like age 17 after I graduated from high school. And I galloped horses in the morning for 4.5 years. And then I rode my first race just to eliminate that as a career option. I was pretty sure I didn't want to do it, that it would be a little too easy. And you know right now that I was an idiot because you rode. You know it's not easy.
Not easy, no.
Yeah, so I came back after riding that first race. My brother happened to be in town. And I said, oh, my God, not only is that the most exciting thing I've ever done, it's the most challenging by far. And I had met my match. And so, as you well know, having been a jockey yourself, you never master the craft. You learn every day. It's challenging every single time you go out there. And I loved it.
So you were hooked from the get-go. That was all you wanted to do after that very first race. And it's so funny hearing that story. You wanted to just eliminate that as an option and then come to find out that's what you loved.
Exactly. Yeah, and I didn't anticipate a lot of the things that happen in a race. Like, I'd watched thousands of races, having watched my mom ride, my brother, my sister, worked on the racetrack and all that. But, you know, you just cannot anticipate how fast everything happens and how, like, the dirt flying back, even though you have goggles on and you know that it's not going to get in your eyes, just that automatic reaction to flinch 1,000 times. And then you realize all of a sudden that your horse is waiting for you to tell it what to do. And you've got to all of a sudden, like, get it all together, stop flinching and start riding a race. And you just, there's really no way to prepare you for all the things that happen in the early stage of a race until you ride one. In fact, Garrick Gomez one time said, he said, when the gate opens, from the time the gate opens until we've gone 5 jumps, there's probably 1,000 different thoughts that run through my head. But they just all have to, you know, happen very, very quickly in split seconds, and you adjust in split second fashion, and it's pretty intense, as you know.
Split second decisions happening constantly. And Donna, I'm assuming that when you decided this is what you wanted to do, given the fact that your mother, such a strong, powerful woman, I'm assuming she was very supportive of that.
Well, my mother, I'll say to her credit, I felt like she always said, I will never encourage nor discourage my children from being jockeys, whatever they want to do, wherever their passion is. And I believed that. And so after I became a jockey, I could tell she was actually pretty happy that I had become a jockey. And so a few months into it, I said to her, you know, you always said that and I always believed that, but I can tell that you're really happy I became a jockey. And she said, that is actually not true. She said, I'm really happy that you have found a passion. She said, I felt like you were wandering around for a while trying to figure out what was going to be the best thing for you. And she said, and now being around you, seeing you in this life as a jockey, I can tell how much it's gripped you and how passionate you are about it. So she said, I'm just thrilled that you have a passion.
I love that. And it has to mm-hmm. be. It really has to be. It has to be your passion. It has to be your life because it's such a demanding career. And tell us about some of the difficult things that people don't really think about, I suppose. Did you have to worry about your weight at all when you rode?
No, and I'm glad I didn't because I don't think I would have done it. I wasn't as motivated as some people are to have to, like, miss meals and stuff. My biggest challenge, Christina, was that when I first started, I weighed 98 pounds, so weight was never a problem. But about 6 months into it, I realized I am not as strong as my male competitors, or some of my female competitors, for that matter. And I wanted to try to start building muscle, but I was only 21. I had no idea where to begin. So I started reading books, and I realized that, and I'm not saying this to be facetious, it's a true story. A 20-something male body can figure out how to build muscle out of chocolate chip cookies. And a 20-something female body wants to figure out how to turn a chicken breast with lettuce and tomato into fat because the body needs to be prepared for that inevitable baby that comes along. And so I finally figured out through proper food combining, never eating proteins and carbohydrates at the same meal, not that I avoided one or the other, but definitely relied more on proteins and vegetables, did have carbohydrates on a somewhat regular basis, but not at the same meal, that I could optimize my digestion in that way, and I could optimize the way my body used the food, to use it as building blocks for muscle. And so for me, that was the challenge, is getting strong enough. And then by the time I feel like I was at, like, what I call my fighting weight, it was 104 pounds. And so I'd put on 6 pounds of muscle. And for, you know, for me, that's where my challenge was. Now, some people build muscle easier than others, but I guess it's been lucky and sometimes not lucky in that now that I've taught my body how to build muscle, it hasn't given it up. So I still have lots of muscle.
It's a good thing.
I don't try to build it anymore.
It's a good thing.
Anyway, so that was one of the challenges. But one thing that was really kind of cool, and I've told my mom this before, is that even though I was sitting in the same room oftentimes when she was giving advice to other riders or to my brother or my sister because they'd asked, I really never felt like I was listening. But then there were times that happened during the course of my career that I could hear her. And the first time was when I had a horse break down with me. And I could hear her say, pull him up to a stop and get off, pull him up to a stop and get off. It was as if she was right there. Like she was sitting on my shoulder, coaching me on what to do. And so I pulled him up to a stop and I got off, stood there with him, obviously, until the ambulance came. He actually ended up being okay. He had a bowed tendon, so it wasn't a fatal injury, but, you know, I could hear what she was telling me to do. And then in another incident, I don't even know how many horses were in the race. I'd be making it up if I told you, but I do know it was a two-turn race at Canterbury, and we were breaking into the turn. I was in the one hole, and there were two other horses who had speed in the race, and I had speed. My horse needed to be on the lead, left alone, or she couldn't win. And the other two horses were like in, let's say, the 3 and the 6. And so I know I've got to send her out of the gate, but I don't want to be in a three-horse speed duel all the way around that first turn, and I know we're all going to gun for the lead. And so I'm even sitting in the gate. I'm sitting there still trying to figure out how I'm going to ride this out. Like, how do you remedy this situation? I can see the writing on the wall. I don't want it to happen. Well, the gate's open, and I send my horse. She breaks well. The other two horses break well, and all of a sudden I could hear my mother say, you don't have to turn left. And so we hit that turn, and I went straight for 2 more strides than I normally would, and then I turned left. And when I did that, I hung them out to dry.
I love it.
And I had my easy lead, and I won. Now, they weren't very happy with me when I came back, but there's really, going into the turn like that, you know, you really don't have to turn left. They just have to, like, not run into you if you go straight. And so it's all fair what I did, but it never occurred to me until I was approaching the turn and I could hear my mother say it. So that was kind of cool.
Race riding, I love it. And you didn't even realize that she was providing all the guidance, but she was there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Were there any other mentors that you really looked up to in the jocks room early on in your career?
Yeah, several. I was fortunate too that so many of them were willing to help me. Diane Nelson was a huge help for me when I got up to Rockingham Park. I had the bug, and like all people who are riding in the dead of winter in New England, I complained about the weather a couple of times. And finally, Diane said to me, like, look, this is your life. You're a jockey. It's an outdoor sport. She said, you're going to need to change your mindset and get back to that mindset of when you were a little kid and you used to want to go out and play in the rain or in the snow and your parents wouldn't let you because it was wet and cold out there. And so now you get to go out and play when it's wet and cold, and you shouldn't be complaining about it. You should be enjoying it. And it really changed the way I thought. And so there were other people, Phil Ernst, who is a rider who maybe isn't a household name, but he was an old timer at Rockingham Park at the time, and he really helped me. And then when I went on to Canterbury Park, I was really grateful that Mike Smith kind of took me in under his wing, and he helped me for 3 or 4 years. Mike would, like, really help me. We rode at Rockingham Park together, Canterbury Downs, and then several tracks later. And so, yeah, all along the way, I had some really Patty Cooksey when I came to Kentucky. She was another one who she rode with my mother. She'd learned a lot from my mother. And it was like she was giving back. And also Julie Crone. Julie and I became great friends. We're still great friends. And she also helped me a ton. So, yeah, lots of great mentors along the way.
That atmosphere in the jocks room obviously can at times get heated, given the fact that we're competitors and we're going out there competing, and then we return to the same room. Now, you mentioned mentors, people who are helping you out in the jocks room, and it's a fine line because people want to help you because they want you to be safe out there, but at the same time, they don't want you to get too good because then you would be beating them. So how was that atmosphere for you like in the jocks room? Did you find that most everyone was pretty helpful, or were there some people that not so much?
Yeah, some people not so much. But, you know, the people who are not so much are going to be that way about everybody. I found that people who had class, people like Patty Cooksey and Julie Crone, and people who were comfortable in their own skin and more had the attitude more like my mother were, if they weren't doing well, it's because either they weren't good enough or people didn't know how good they were, are less likely to blame people who are doing better than they are on their lack of what they perceive to be the success they should be having. And so, I mean, while there was some of that, I didn't buy into it very much. So I never really had any entanglements with people that, you know, like when I was riding at Birmingham, when I started riding, I was at Birmingham Turf Club in 1987 in their inaugural season. There were 17 apprentice riders there and also 17 female riders there because it was this new meet where a lot of people came together and were looking for opportunities. And, you know, it was like a place to get a fresh start. And one of the girls in the jocks room, actually a couple of the girls in the jocks room said to me that this other girl, her name was Connie, I can't even remember her last name, when I wasn't there, that Connie said something negative and said, oh, the only reason why people ride Donna Barton on horses is because she's cute. And I thought, okay, well, first of all, I don't think I'm that cute, at least not cute enough to convince people to ride me on their horses. And secondly, and the reason why they told me this is because they knew what I knew. Secondly, when I'm at the barn area at 5:15 a.m., I've never seen Connie. Like, I do know that I work harder than anybody else that I know. And so I just had a tendency to feel sorry for people who didn't, like, get it enough to realize that it was them, that they were the reason, not anybody around them. And so, you know, like, I had true friends in the jocks room who would tell me something like that. Hey, by the way, just in case you ever think Connie's your friend, she's not. This is what she said. But I was also able to just brush it off and just be like, well, I've noticed that the harder I work, the luckier I get. And maybe I look cute when I'm feeling lucky. Who knows?
Love it. Jockey Donna Barton Brothers is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Donna, you mentioned the Birmingham Turf Club. That is the location of your first victory in 1987. Mm-hmm. Take us back to that day.
I was on a horse named Discover Acro, I think. Yeah, that's the horse I won my first race on.
That's what I have in my notes, Discover Acro. Yes.
Yeah, like it's like been over 30 years at this point. So. Anyway, yeah, the thing is I came from off the pace, and it was just one of those things like where I was, you know, back in the early stages of the race, and then as I rounded that second turn, I had moved up to fourth, and it didn't occur to me that I could win this race yet. Like, I'm still just like passing a horse, and none of these were great horses we were talking about, in particularly in that race at Birmingham. And then all of a sudden I looked up and thought, oh my God, there's only one horse left in front of me. Like, I could win this race. And I just started riding the best that I could at the time, which was pretty lame, but I did start riding, and Discover Acro was responding and she wanted to win. And so yeah, it was pretty exciting because I don't know about, like, when you won your first race, or I really haven't talked to a lot of people about when they win their first race, but you don't really have, like, you don't anticipate it happening until it's like, oh my God, I'm going to win this, because by the time most riders get to win their first race, they've been beaten so many times.
Yes.
Already.
Yes.
So, yeah, that was my experience. I'm guessing yours was similar, it sounds like.
I didn't even know if I won my first race. It was a photo, and I wasn't seasoned enough to be able to judge that. And I had to ask the outrider after pulling up if I won.
Sweat it out.
Exactly. So, Donna, eventually, and I'm looking at the clock here, and I have to speed it up a little bit. I told you this hour would fly by, but eventually, you're one of the main riders for the great Dwayne Lucas. And tell us how you got into that spot.
Well, probably because I was a little bit silly and brazen. I came to Kentucky to ride in 1993. And I was riding for people like David Carroll, who's now assistant trainer for Mark Cassie, Carl Nasker, Tom Proctor. So I had some good people I was riding for in Chicago. And we were all going to Florida for the winter, but Keeneland for the fall ended up being the stopping off point on the way. And so I came to ride the Keeneland fall meet because all my clients had left. And so on opening day, I won. I was on four horses opening day of Keeneland. I won three races, which was one of the best days of my career ever because I was always intimidated by the whole going to Keeneland thing because I just thought I would starve to death there. Mm-hmm. And so to win three races on opening day I was just over the moon. So the next day I said to my agent, I want to find out what barn Wayne Lucas is in because I want to go meet him. And so he told me, like, he figured it out what barn he was in. And we walked up to him, and he was standing there talking with Todd Pletcher, who at the time was his assistant trainer. And so we just stood off to the side, you know, a respectful distance away where he could see we were waiting to talk to him, but not close enough that we could overhear their conversation. And so when they wrapped it up, like, they both kind of turned to us, like, can I help you? And so I walked over there and said, hello, Mr. Lucas. My name is Donna Barton. I won three races here yesterday on opening day, which makes me the leading rider. And I've read a lot about you. I know you always like to ride the hot hand. And right now that's me. So I was pretty sure you were going to want to meet me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So luckily I was brazen enough to do that because all the confidence that it would take to say and do something like that, I truly wasn't feeling, but I'd convinced myself that this would be the way to approach a guy like Wayne Lucas. And it worked. So that meet, Pat Day went out of town one day, and I got to ride two horses for him that day. They both finished fourth, and when we came back, he told me I was overriding. He said, you're trying too hard. Just let it unfold. Let it happen. So I went to Florida for the winter. He never rode me on any horses in Florida. And when I came back in the spring, and he was out in California all winter. Todd oversaw the operation in Florida at the time. So when we got back to Churchill Downs in the spring, I just started going by his barn every morning at like 10 till 5 because nobody else was out there at 10 till 5. And every day I would just say, do you have any horses you need work this morning? And then finally one day he said yes. And he started letting me work some of the horses in the morning. And he saw that I had a good rapport with horses, that horses liked me and I liked them. And then when Pat couldn't ride a horse here or there, I would get an opportunity, and it turned into me riding a lot of horses for Wayne. And for about 3 or 4 years, I worked all of the good horses, so Timber Country and Prince of Thieves and Thunder Gulch and Serena Song and Tabasco Cat and, you know, all those good horses that he had then. I didn't necessarily ride them all in a race, but I was working them all in the morning, and I had a really good clock in my head. And so it just gave me an in with one of the best stables in America and one of the best horsemen that I've ever been around.
Do you remember that first really big opportunity he gave you as far as big win?
I remember that he let me ride Catapult in the Breeders' Cup juvenile fillies. But I don't think he really felt like she had a chance to win, and she didn't. I mean, she was a sprinter. I mean, she ended up winning some graded stakes races sprinting later in her career, age 3 and 4. We won the Thoroughbred Club of America Stakes over at Keeneland when she was 3. So she ended up being a good horse. But I think he just gave me that mount to, like, give me a mount in the Breeders' Cup. The Breeders' Cup was held at Churchill Downs that year. And so slowly he started to let me have more mounts like that. And then the biggest probably opportunity that he gave me was Hennessy in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile in 1995. And I want to say Hennessy was something like 10 to 1, But I felt like he was a 4-5 shot. I didn't think there was any way Hennessy could get beat. I'd been riding him prior to that. I'd won the Sapling Stakes on him in Monmouth Park. I'd ridden at Monmouth Park that summer for Wayne specifically. And so anyway, I just didn't see any way that he would get beat. And he ended up running second, and he got beat by a horse named Unbridled Song, mm-hmm. who at the time was a little-known horse, but obviously went on to be a very good horse. And Hennessy didn't his career didn't pan out as a three-year-old. He had an injury early in his three-year-old career and didn't make any of the Triple Crown races. But I think, you know, his legacy showed. He ended up being a good producer. His legacy showed that he was a good horse, just probably a bit unproven. But, yeah, it was great that he gave me the opportunity to ride him. And even though we finished second in there, Wayne knew and I knew that I had gotten everything out of Hennessy that he had to offer. That we just got beat fair and square by another horse. And that was one thing I did like about riding for Wayne, is that, you know, he would understand that.
What was he like? You mentioned that, but what was he like to ride for, as far as what he give you complicated instructions in the paddock, or what he just pretty much leave it up to you?
I actually joked with Jerry Bailey the other day. We were talking about riding for Wayne. And I said, here's the thing about Wayne. Every time you'd walk out to the paddock, he'd say, I want you laying 1-2-3 going into that first turn. Or in the first eighth of a mile, I want you laying 1-2-3. Those were his instructions always. Unless, on a rare occasion, he would say, I want you laying 1-2-3-4. And if he said 4, my first thought was, I have got no horse. For Wayne to say, I want you laying 1-2-3-4, he doesn't think this horse can run at all. So really, probably what got me into Wayne's barn is that I was a really good gate rider, as they say. I could get horses away from the gate really well. And Wayne is a firm believer that races are won and lost in that first 16th of a mile, and so am I. And so if you can, you know, not give a horse to overcome in the first few steps away from the starting gate, you can give them nothing to overcome. You know, have a horse be good in the starting gate for you and then get away cleanly, I feel like it gives you a huge advantage. And so that was one reason why things went well for me with Wayne. And also, I'll tell you a little secret about two-year-olds, and I learned this from Mike Smith, that jockeys don't talk about a lot, is that, you know, when you're a rider and you ride older horses in the starting gate, as you well know, Christina, it's really important to just sit there quietly and to sit there still, because they're waiting, waiting, waiting. Anytime you move, they're going to be like, now, 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 now.
Yeah.
And if you can't keep them just standing there on all fours, then they're not going to break well. So you have to be as quiet as you can and not give them any indication it's time to go until a second before it's time to go, and then time that just right.
Right.
Two-year-olds are a little different. Two-year-olds don't get it yet. And so you have to, like, move around on them in the starting gate a little bit. You might have to jiggle the bit in their mouth. You might even have to, like, slap them on the shoulder a little bit to, like, go, like, hey, like, get your head in the game. This is a horse race here. And a lot of riders, maybe they get that now, but they certainly didn't get it when I was riding. And it made me really good away from the gate with two-year-olds, because I wasn't afraid to wake up a two-year-old in the starting gate. And it's completely the opposite of the way you sit on an older horse in the starting gate. And so because I was getting the two-year-olds out of the starting gate, well, Wayne let me ride a lot of the two-year-olds. So that really helped me.
Donna, let's take a quick break. We will be right back. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judges' choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Donna Barton Brothers. And Donna, right before the break, you were describing your riding style. You're a good gate rider, and you're talking about riding for the great Dwayne Lucas. And would you say that obviously riders want to be good at everything? They want to be good coming from behind on the grass, speed, whatever it is. But would you say riding for someone like Dwayne Lucas and being so good out of the gate, would you say you had that tendency to be really good on the front end?
Well, Wayne liked his horses forwardly placed. That didn't necessarily mean on the lead, but 1, 2, 3, always his instructions, lay 1, 2, 3. And so, you know, if you're going to be that kind of a rider and ride those kind of horses, it's really important to have a good clock in your head. And so one of my early mentors was a guy who's an agent now. His name's Bobby Kelly. And we galloped horses together for a guy in Louisiana whose name escapes me at the moment. But I worked horses with Bobby when I was 18, 19 years old, and he had a really good clock in his head. And when you work horses with somebody who has a good clock in their head, you learn to have one too, especially if they're trying to teach you that. And so I learned early to have a really good clock in my head. And it was one of the things that got me into Wayne's barn is that working horses went well. If he said to go in 101, I went in 101. But the other thing is like we were talking about, when you're riding horses that are forwardly placed, like a lot of Wayne's horses, it's super important to have a good clock in your head, because if somebody is in front of you, you need to understand if they're in front of you because they're flying or if they're in front of you and backing the pace up on you. And mm-hmm. So, you know, like not to just let them go out there in a dawdling pace of like 25 in a sprint race or 24 in a sprint race and then, you know, like a put up a 49 half and you're sitting off of it, then you're just an idiot. Or at the same time, if you're on the lead, you need to know if you're going fast. And so I think those things go hand in hand. You know, if you're going to be a good gate rider and you're going to ride for people who like to have their horses forwardly paced, replaced, you better have a good clock in your head. I think it all goes together.
Donnie, you, as I mentioned in the introduction, you had large number of victories, over 1,100 victories. And out of those, that great number, what were some of your highlights? If you had to play a highlight reel, what would be on it?
Actually, I've never been asked that question before. It's a great question, though, Christina. One of my favorite fillies was a filly named Country Cat that I rode for Wayne. She won the Gardenia Stakes over at Ellis Park. And prior to that, I'd won a race on her, I think at Churchill Downs, the allowance race. And then, anyway, one of the reasons why she was one of my favorite horses, though, is because she was by Stormcat, and so a lot of the Stormcat fillies were really fickle by nature. So they might do a weird thing, like just be galloping on the racetrack and have to pee, and then just stop and pee in the middle of the racetrack in the middle of a gallop. And if you would see a filly doing that on the track, anybody who was around the Stormcats would go, let me guess, she's by Stormcat. They were just so fickle, and she was absolutely no exception. There were very few things that you could get by telling her to do. Everything had to be a suggestion, and she didn't like being forwardly placed, so she didn't fit into Wayne's program of 1, 2, 3. It was like, how about we break and you lay wherever you want. Wayne wasn't in town. And so normally when he had been in town, he always wanted me forwardly placed with her, but he wasn't in town. He didn't give me any instructions over the phone. And so I was able to just ride her the way I wanted to ride her. And Larry Melanson after the race said, I can tell Wayne Lucas wasn't in town because I was able to sit like seventh, eighth, well off the early pace. And then whenever she was ready to start running, like we were able to just find a nice path, and she closed strong. And she just had such a great personality. She was just a filly who the only thing she liked to do was run. She didn't like to train. She didn't like to be pet. None of those things. And so, you know, you love a horse like that. Hennessy, one of my favorites, because he always gave 110% no matter what. But he was a horse who, if you got on him in the morning and when you rode him in the post parade, he would buck and play like a two-year-old let out of a cage for the first time. And then when the starting gate opened, he was all business. Or in a morning work, all business. And Serena Song actually rode her in the last race of her career. She didn't win that day. She was second. But she was a filly who was really awesome to be around, because when you would work her in the morning, she was so sensitive and wanted to go super, super fast that you had to just sit with a really long hold. If you took too much hold, she would take a hold back. She'd take off. If you had too little of a hold, she would take off. If you were going along in about what you felt was like a 12 and 3 and you wanted her to pick it up to be like a 12 and 1 eighth of a mile, if you moved a finger, she would take off. If you smooched, she would take off. So it was all just like trying to figure out how to make her not overdo it. And so for Serena, when you work her in the morning and you wanted her to pick it up just a little bit, I would just go, which was just a little gentle sniffle in case she couldn't hear it.
Wow.
And then she would be like, was that a smooch? I think that might have been a smooch. And she would pick it up just a little bit. And so she just had such a great personality. And, yeah, there were just so many. Boston Harbor, he was amazing. I'm mentioning a lot of Wayne's horses because I think, you know, with Wayne, I got to ride so many of his horses in the afternoon. But also I worked him in the morning a lot, so I really developed nice long-term relationships with him. Lord Carson, one of my favorites. There's tons. Hoyster Flag is a filly that I love that I rode in Minnesota, who was a big old white mare who won stakes up there, I think, three summers in a row that I got a rider in, and she was awesome, too.
You know, Don, it was funny. When I was preparing for this show, I looked up Serena's Song to see what you two did together. And as you mentioned, you rode her in her last race. It's funny because I pulled up the chart of that last race, and you ran second, and that race was won by Frank Brothers. And so now I have to ask you, how did you and Frank meet?
Well, I'd known Frankie since I was like maybe 18 years old when I was galloping horses down in Louisiana, and he was the leading trainer there at Louisiana Downs and then the fairgrounds. And quite frankly, I was pretty intimidated by him. He's a guy who was always nose to the grindstone in the mornings, and you could say good morning, Mr. Brothers, to him, and he wouldn't even hear you because his mind is just all about the horses all the time. And so I was pretty intimidated by the guy, but respected him. And then I went to Arlington Park in 1992 or 91 for the first time in the summer, and I didn't know a lot of people, and I was trying to start, you know, riding for people. But he was somebody who I had met. I'd galloped a few horses for him in Louisiana, so I would stop by his barn regularly. Hello, Miss Brothers. Can I do anything for you this morning? And then finally, and it was odd because in 1993, we ended up both working out at the same gym, and we both were runners. And so it was this little tiny track inside this gym that to go 1 mile was 11 times around. So if you ran anywhere near the same pace, you would just run along with somebody and just chat and talk to him or whatever. And we just started talking, running laps there at the gym. And obviously I got to know him in a different way than just, good morning, Mr. Brothers. Do you need anything this morning? And yeah, we just started seeing each other shortly after that. But I will say we dated for 2.5 years. We broke up for 2 years. And then we got back together, and a year and a half later we were married, and we've since lived happily ever after. We were married in 1998. But when he beat me and I was second on Serena's Song, I wasn't dating him then. So I wasn't all happy for him having won that race. There was nothing about that race that made me happy. It's not like one of those things where, well, at least you won it. I'm like, really? my asshole ex-boyfriend. I shouldn't say that because he was never a jerk. But still, he was my ex-boyfriend at the time. So nothing about that made me happy.
That is too funny. Well, obviously glad you guys worked it out, got back together. Like you said, lived happily ever after. And you got married
in
1998. That's also the year you retired. Was that, were they related at all? Or were you just at that point in your life where you didn't want to ride races anymore?
Yeah, they were related just because of that. You know, we had dated, as I said, off and on for a few years. But there's this archaic rule in racing that says that if a jockey and a trainer get married, any time a trainer starts a horse in a race, the jockey, who is their spouse, either has to ride that horse or they can't ride the race. Which meant that any time, if Frankie and I got married, any time he ran a horse, I would have to ride it or I couldn't ride the race. And, you know, for years I rode for Wayne Lucas, Carl Nassar, I mean, some pretty nice outfits, and there was no way I was going to say, oh, I'm sorry, can't ride your horse in there. No, I don't ride for anybody else. It's just that Frankie has a horse and Shane Sellers is riding it. And like,
yeah.
So I rode for Frankie, but I never wanted to ride all of his horses. I mean, I didn't want to ride all the horses for anybody, much more somebody you're that closely, you know, involved with. And so we just didn't get married for years because of that. Neither one of us wanted to have children. We were on the road way too much to even contemplate that. And, then in 1998, it was the fall of 98. And, you know, this is a game of peaks and valleys. We've all been through them. As a jockey, you have career highs, you have lows. And sometimes you know, your business gets low and you know how hard you're going to have to work to get your business back again. But I was at a little bit of a lull and I knew how hard I would have to work to build my business back up again. And I just didn't feel like doing it anymore. I was just done with it. And I had become disenchanted with the whole idea of, you know, how hard we work and the whole, like, all of it. And also, I think I'd become a little bit afraid, which I didn't really realize as part of it at the time. But there were a couple of times when I would be riding a race and my horse would just suddenly disappear out from underneath me. And then a second later, I would realize that that had not happened, that the race was still happening and my horse was still running. And so that was a little, you know, a bit of an awakening. And so Frankie and I talked and just said, you know, maybe this is the time. Like, I don't want to ride anymore. And so we decided to, I announced my retirement and our engagement at the same time.
That's wonderful. That is wonderful. And with, again, 1,171 victories, I mean, you had already accomplished so much and on to that next chapter in your life. And how did you then get into broadcasting?
Well, I didn't really know I would get into broadcasting when I retired. I just thought I'd marry Frankie and live happily ever after, and who knew what would happen. And, you know, I just was fortunate because I had been interviewed several times as a jockey. And when I was riding so much for Wayne, he would just have, like, after we would work those derby horses, he would have them talk to me instead of him. And so it just kind of naturally happened where a local TV station here, WHAS, Julie Koenig was the name of the person. She said, you know, hey, you want to do this Racing 101 with me Derby Week? And then, or maybe it was Breeders' Cup Week. I don't know. Just, you know, a little thing here, a little thing there. We were going to New Orleans for the winter. We were married in November. We were going to New Orleans for the winter. And the fairgrounds asked me if I wanted to interview the winning connections of the stakes races just on the weekends, just for their in-house stuff. So I did that. And then I came back to Churchill Downs in the spring. John Asher had been promoted to vice president, so he wasn't going to be able to do the handicapping segments with Mike Battaglia anymore. So he asked me if I was interested in doing that. So I did that. Now, meanwhile, I'm still galloping horses for Frankie in the morning every day. And so these other TV gigs were just, you know, sort of like, as they say in Louisiana, lanyap, just something I did on the side. And then I happened to be at Churchill Downs when NBC came to observe what they were getting into. They came in 2000 because they were going to cover the Kentucky Derby for the first time in 2001. And they saw my work there and asked me if I would be interested in joining the broadcast team. And I said yes. And that was it. I've been with them since 2000.
How easy of a transition was that for you, Don? Obviously, there two totally different things, riding on the back of a 1,000-pound animal and then speaking to audiences across the world on television. How was that? Was it easy for you, or did you find parts of it challenging?
It wasn't easy at all. It wasn't as easy as I thought it would be, kind of like race riding, right?
Yeah.
I'm just, like, so naive about how hard other things are that people do. But, you know, it takes a while, as you well know, better than anybody, because you ask great questions. But it takes a while to realize that in order to interview somebody well, first of all, you do your homework. So you're going to know a lot about that person before you ever talk to them. So these questions you're asking me, most of them you already know the answer to because you've done your homework. But you know that they're questions that you want to ask because they're going to elicit a story that you want to hear told. So this is the way you do it. So it took me a while to figure that out, Christine. I was a little slow. So, you know, the Robbie Alvarado would win the stakes race down in Louisiana. We're at the fairgrounds. And, I mean, I could see that the decisive move was when he made his move at the 3/8 pole. And, I mean, from the quarter pole on, you could always tell he was going to win. So, like, now they come back, and I don't know what to ask Robbie. I don't have any questions for him. I mean, I could tell when he made his move. I could tell when he knew he had the race won. And so I had to learn, you know, to say, like, you know, Robbie, at what point in the race did you feel like you made the move that changed the outcome for you, that separated you from the field? Even though I knew it was at the 3/8 pole, right?
Like, right.
So that was a challenge, is to ask questions I already knew the answer to. And then I found out there were things I didn't know, because then sometimes you get an answer you're surprised about. Like, what if he had said, well, at the 5/8 pole, I did blah, blah. Well, then that leads to a whole nother then chain of questions. And so that was new. The other thing is that NBC, and I think pretty much all of them, I did one show for ESPN early on, none of them tell you what you're going to do or how to do it. They just tell you what your role is going to be. Donna, you're going to interview the jockeys after each race, and we'll come to you when the horses are in the post parade. If there's anything to report, let us know. But they don't tell you what kind of questions to ask. They don't tell you how long. They don't tell you how many, nothing. And so a new challenge that I had interviewing the jockeys is that in almost every case, I've not seen the race. And so I'm as blind as the viewer who's at home and doesn't know how to watch a horse race, and the horse just came from dead last. And so that was a new challenge for me, but I realized that, you know, most of our viewers, unless the horse goes leads the whole way around there, most of them don't really understand where the winner came from anyway. So it's just as well I don't know. So when I ask them and they start to talk about it, then the viewers also are learning something that they didn't know. So, yeah, there's always challenges, right? Like every new thing, there's always challenges. And then plus, at NBC, one of the challenges is that I've worked for several different producers now. And that would be like riding for several different trainers with different training styles. And so every producer has a different way that they kind of want the show to go. And you have to be flexible and realize that, you know, just because this style worked for this guy. Like, we've had one producer who likes everything to be super organic and nothing is pre-planned. And, you know, just go interview somebody and see how it goes and take us to the action. And then we have other producers who want every single hit timed down to 2 seconds. So if he says you've got a 40-second hit, he doesn't mean 43 seconds or 37. He means 40. So you have to be flexible on that, too.
Donna, when I read that, your answer to part of that question was that you don't see the race before you interview the jockeys. And when I read that, I was absolutely shocked, because I never would have guessed that by watching you interview these riders. And that just astonishes me. And so you mentioned, you know, you would think it was challenging, but maybe it's actually beneficial, because you're just going in there and you don't know anything. So you're asking the riders what happened. But why is that? So is that, are you moving around on horseback to the correct location, or why is that exactly?
Yeah, because there's no camera back there in the position where I start interviewing them. So wherever this race starts from, I have to get back to that spot as soon as possible, because they can't be back there waiting for me, because I'm watching the race somewhere. I've got to be back there riding, waiting for them. And so if it's like the Kentucky Derby, then when the horses leave the starting gate, I'll go the wrong way of the racetrack, meaning the opposite direction of the horses that they're running in. So they break, they go straight ahead, they're going to take a left-hand turn when they hit the turn. I'm going to go the opposite way that they're going, and I'm going to take a right-hand turn around that that my first turn, their second turn. When they start to come towards me on the backside, I'm going to stop, make my horse stand still, let the field go by me. Then I'm going to take off again and meet them up in the. So I've seen them for like 2 seconds when they went by me, and that's about it. In the Preakness Stakes, I leave the starting gate right behind them. The starting gate flies open. I take off right behind them, and I follow them away from the starting gate into that first turn. And so, you know, I see when I go past that, like the, if there's monitors, if there's good monitors on the track or around that first turn, then I have a chance to be able to see a little bit. But I've actually learned that it's a lot easier for me if I just listen to the call of the race, just listen to Lynn Colmes' call, because keep in mind that I'm riding a horse. Hundreds of thousands of people, or I should say tens of thousands of people in the grandstand. My horse could spook from almost anything at any time. I'm listening to the call of the race. I'm making sure that I'm getting into position. And so then if I also add trying to watch the race to it, it screws me up. It's just too much sensory overload. So at this point, I'm just used to tuning in and listening to the call of the race. And we're fortunate, I mean, since I've been with NBC, we've had Tom Durkin and Larry Colmes, two of the greatest announcers of all time. And so they don't miss a lot. So like when Animal Kingdom, you know, at the start at Belmont Park, you know, he was bothered away from the starting gate. John Velasquez lost an iron, got his iron back. I knew all that happened only because I heard Larry talk about it. But other than that, I probably wouldn't have been able to see it. Because at that point, by the way, I was still behind the starting gate. Like I would have been, I had an obstructed view.
Jockey Donna Barton Brothers is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Donna, favorite interview ever? What is it?
Well, I think a lot of viewers' favorite interview is the first Kentucky Derby that Calvin Burrell won, because he was so emotional. And
yes,
and one of the things I do love about Calvin is that he's just raw emotion. He doesn't know how to be anything other than genuinely who he is. But another person who's that way is Mike Smith. He doesn't hold anything back. He's, you know, there's a lot of guys and girls who I interview who I feel like all of their words are measured responses to how everything they say is going to be perceived. And Mike is, he's been so well-spoken for so long, and he's so, like, his words come so much from his heart, and he has such a good heart that he doesn't have measured responses. He really does come from his heart and speak openly about what's on his mind and mostly what's in his heart. And it doesn't take Mike very long to get from what he's thinking to what he's feeling. And I think a lot of jockeys, when you interview them after a race, they feel like they need to rein in their emotion and save that for later. And right now, just talk from what's in their head. And I think the viewers really prefer to hear about what's in their heart. And Mike's never afraid to do that.
Well, and you do such a great job in bringing that out of them as well, Donna. And
well, thank you.
We only have about 4 minutes left here on the show. It is going by way too fast. But I'm excited about an article I just read where you have partnered to create the Thoroughbred Women's Network. And please tell our audience what that is and what that's all about.
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. It was actually Anna Seitz's idea from Fasig Tipton. And she brought a group of about 35 women together at the Fasig Tipton Saratoga Select Sale this past summer. And said, you know, like, here's the thing. We've had the perception, at least, of an old boys network and thoroughbred racing, lots of businesses for a long time. And this old boys network, I think, was never intended to exclude women or young women, but there's never been a way to include young women either. And so if you've got a 13, 15, 17, 19-year-old daughter who wants to get involved in the thoroughbred industry and you're not in the thoroughbred industry, where do you even begin? Like, you know, how do you help her fulfill her dream, her passion, when you don't know anything about the thoroughbred industry, the people, the players, and all that stuff yourself? And so the Thoroughbred Women's Network was designed to really give young women an introduction into the sport through mentoring. And so a lot of the women who were at that meeting, that initial meeting, signed up to be mentors. And so, for instance, my first mentee is a girl who's 13 years old. Her family lives in Indiana. They don't live anywhere near a racetrack in Indiana. She's wanted to be a jockey since she was eight. She weighs 85 pounds. And she's been riding horses since she was 4 years old at a jumper, Hunter Jumper Stable. But, you know, they wouldn't have a clue how to get her into the industry. And so now all of a sudden I'm like, how do I keep this 13-year-old girl safe? Like, she becomes my project, right? But it's a great thing, I think, for – and by the way, in no way am I, like, trying to exclude the men in this. I feel like it's just been easier for a parent to say to a 17-year-old, sure, you can go live and work on Coolmore Farm in Lexington for the summer, where they wouldn't do that with their 17-year-old daughter. And so there's going to be often times whenever the mentor for these young women is going to be a male mentor. It's just a matter of just trying to figure out the best place to put them and how to keep them safe and give them the tools and the skills they need to know to pursue the avenues they want.
So in this case, Donna, this girl from Indiana who's 13, what kind of a path do you want to set her down?
Well, the first thing is, you know, you need to get strong. One of the first things I did was took her to a yoga class with me to basically let her see that she, at this point, can barely handle her own body weight, much more the weight of a 1,200-pound animal. And so I wanted her to see that even though she is athletic and she can ride horses, she's not nearly as strong enough as she wants to be or needs to be to deal with the thoroughbreds. And so the very first thing I want her to do, first of all, I sent her books. I sent her Stevie Coffin's book, The Kid, by Pete Axthom. I sent her a book called Sport of Kings about several women jockeys. I sent her Julie Crone's book, Riding for Your Life, or Riding for My Life, whatever it is. So I sent her several books and said, you need to read these over the course of the next year. We'll talk about them. And next summer, I want to see her go to work at a riding, she goes to a riding stable every day and rides her horse. But I want to see her not live an hour away from that riding stable. I want her to live closer to the riding stable and catch ride as much as she can so that she gets used to riding a lot of other people's horses.
Well, Donna, we are out of time. I'm so sorry to cut you off. We are all out of time.
Okay.
But good luck with that. I'm so excited to see you taking charge with the Thoroughbred Women's Network. Excited to see where that will go. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website. That's horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can listen to. Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, Express Bet Radio, the list goes on. And be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.